that are for themselves, that is to say, consciousness, minds. Have I lost you? I'm talking about spirit as the resolution here. Now, spirit has a subjective side, thinking, the introspective side of our thinking, which we would call psychology. But spirit also has an objective side where it's related to other spirit, other minds. And that we would consider ethics, sociology, and politics, the way we relate to other thinkers and other minds, ethically, sociologically, and politically. How do we have the psychological way of understanding spirit and the sociological, ethical, political way of understanding spirit resolved? Hegel said, in absolute spirit, not just spirit psychologically or spirit sociologically, but absolute spirit, which is manifested in the consciousness of art, religion, and philosophy. Okay, so spirit, if you will, has a triad of, I'm oversimplifying, but Hegel will have to allow me to do that because every truth is oversimple. Isn't this great? Once you learn to play the game, you can do this. Anyway, to be oversimple with you, spirit is itself a matter of psychology and sociology being resolved in art, philosophy, and religion. And it's in philosophy, which is the highest triad of these, it's in philosophy that we reach absolute self-knowledge, a level of consciousness which is completely determinative, that is not vague, but rich and varied, and yet is passed beyond all limitation of being and has no other, has no object outside of itself. It becomes the world as perfected thought. It's in philosophy in particular that we finally reach absolute spirit, perfected thought. Pardon my being a little cynical, but what did Hegel do for a living? He was a philosopher. Well, I wouldn't want to suggest that he had any biases that he was working out in his philosophy, any prejudice here, but it is always just a little bit annoying, especially to people who don't have an inclination to teach philosophy or to portray themselves as philosophers, that the philosophers always think they're at the top of the ladder, you know, the apex of being. Anyway, Hegel is even worse than what I am kind of snidely suggesting right now. It wasn't just that he thought philosophy in general was the apex of absolute spirit, because there is no philosophy in general, is there? That would be too abstract. That's one of those vague concepts that needs to be made more definite. What is the definite philosophy that is the apex of all philosophical development and self-consciousness? Well, it's Hegel's philosophy. All right, so we have to remember that the truth is the whole. Hegel was not a relativist. He believed that all these different levels of consciousness, all of this dialectical process, was part of one monistic objective order in the end. There's a hierarchy of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, but all of this dialectical, all of these dialectical triads are ultimately incorporated and transcended into something that's not a version of reality, but is reality as a whole. The truth is the whole. Now, we can understand this. Again, I'm trying to play the game and make it more digestible for you. We can understand this in one sense, if you remember, that thought and being, thought and nature, must be reconciled in one monistic unity, because as long as you are thinking about something, you're drawing a distinction. Okay? And if you're drawing a distinction, then you don't have the total. You don't have what is the whole truth. Therefore, whenever we do get to the whole truth, which cannot be divided from anything else, the truth and what we call the object of knowing have got to be the same thing. Truth and reality must ultimately be the same thing. Which, for those of you who have gone through the ancient philosophy course, will sound very Platonic to you. It turns out that idea, truth, and being are one and the same for the idealist. Hegel said, if you have the absolute truth, then you have to have the absolute unqualified reality at the same time. Hegel, therefore, longed for a system of philosophy which displayed actual, determinate, systematic, and necessary relationships between all the information that we have as men that's been acquired over the centuries. And what his phenomenology of mind was a prospectus for taking everything that men know and all of their experiences and bringing them together in this triadic hierarchy until we finally reach absolute spirit. Okay, there were some questions that I've suppressed for a moment here. Right here?
Which
is absolute spirit.
Perfected thought, right?
Yeah. You have spirit, and then it develops into absolute spirit. What he just did. He just proved it in that because it's absolute, it cannot be any thinking about something else. If it's thinking about something else and it's qualified and it's not absolute, it's not the total truth. And so for it to be the total truth, it would also have to be total reality at the same time. Some people are impressed with that proof and some people aren't. My guess is, judging from the way you're looking at me, you aren't. But that is Hegel's approach to it. Hegel said, if you think about this long enough, the total truth would have to be total reality also. Because if it was truth about something, then you wouldn't be the total truth. You would be distinguishing between the knower and the known. Okay? That's right. Hegel would say, this problematic that you have raised for me is just an illustration of what I'm getting at. Because every conceptualization of the situation is going to have the seeds of its own destruction within it. And so now you're having difficulty with this because you're saying, well now, Herr Professor, how could you even say this? Well, his answer is because we haven't reached absolute spirit yet. So we're now still dialectically discussing it. But when the day comes that we reach it, there'll be no more discussion because all will be one. Now, so you understand that Hegel had this grand system that he proposed, but the project was a failure. It was a failure because, one, he never finished it. Who could finish a project like that? He never finished it, and the sections of the system that he gave attention, we've looked at a few illustrations today, I think are weak and unconvincing. Where they are true, I think they're trivial. And where they may have something a little more of a bite to them, I think they're really unconvincing because they aren't accurate or true at all. And he certainly does not display, even in the small portion of this dialectical hierarchy, he does not display that the relationships are necessary and that they are determinate, fully accurate. Or to let me put it in simple language to you. It seems to me that Hegel is the perfect picture of the armchair philosopher who is speculating in this vague way with arbitrary pontifications about the way things must be and how things relate to each other. You know, we have a tendency in American and British thinking. I recognize this as a tendency that's already there, kind of a prejudice, but it may be a healthy one to say, you know, we want something a little more tangible as proof. We don't like philosophers who just sit in their armchairs and pontificate about how all these vague categories are related to each other. But Hegel, I think, is the perfect illustration of that. He never finished the pontifications, and when he did pontificate, sometimes it seemed very weak and altogether unconvincing. Nevertheless, Hegel himself was hardly humble about the rational system that he was developing. Hegel considered this rational system the culmination of reason coming to self-consciousness. That's worth a few moments reflection at home, if nothing else, just the chase in you and anybody else who has some grand rational design. Hegel felt that his philosophy, the system he was developing, was the culmination of reason coming to self-consciousness. Wow. I mean, that's heady stuff. He equated his system with scientific knowledge. Everything else was unscientific, because everything else lacked requisite universality and determinative accuracy. Only in Hegel's system do you get true science and rationality at its highest self-conscious level. Well, if you're not already just swamped with this man's pride in his rationality, let me overwhelm you with a quote from the introduction to his Logic. In the introduction to Logic, Hegel claimed that his work is, please write this down, and I quote, "the account of God as he is in his eternal essence before the creation of nature and any finite spirit." End of quote. I'll say it again. This is Hegel describing in the preface to his work, or the introduction to his work, what the work is. And Hegel said this work is, quote, "the account of God as he is in his eternal essence before the creation of nature and any finite spirit." So I've tried to give this to you in small steps, and we can finally get to this plunge here. Hegel said that his philosophy, his system of reasoning, was the culmination of mind and its self-consciousness. It was fully scientific over against everything else. And in a word, it was God. It is the account of God. It's not absolute spirit itself, because we're still in the dialectical process of history. But it's the account of God as he is in his eternal essence. That is to say, Hegel considered his individual mind as a manifestation of the universal mind thinking within him. The universal mind in German, the German term that he used was Weltgeist, Weltgeist. Geist is spirit or mind. Welt, world, or universal. The Weltgeist was thinking through Hegel's individual Geist. And so the big mind, the universal mind, was working its way out through Hegel's philosophy. Wow. Talk about big claims. I mean, is there a bigger claim than that? Are you sympathetic to this kind of thing? How do you receive it when Paul and Peter say that they are born by the Spirit of God so that their words are the very words of God? So you're really accustomed to these kinds of claims, because in Christianity we hear them all the time, at least in Orthodox historic Christianity, because the apostles and the prophets claimed that the absolute mind, pardon the the unholy way of putting it, God is himself thinking or speaking through them. The reason I use this analogy is because I want you to see that there is a great tension and competition then between the utter rationalism of a Hegel and the humble religion of the Christian, because he thought God, Weltgeist, the universal mind or spirit, was speaking through his philosophy. We think God was speaking through his son and those who are apostles and prophets of his son. This puts the whole debate into a different light, I think, and I want you to appreciate that. There's a worldview war, a religious war going on between Hegel and Christianity. And yet Hegel claimed that Christianity was to be interpreted as a low-level expression of his philosophy. Okay, Mike? I appreciate very much that testimony. I think you're absolutely right, too. I do hope that the study of philosophy leads all of you to that kind of testimony, that you can understand that, appreciate what God has given you. Now, I'm not taking anything away from it. As I already told you, I'm heart and soul in agreement with you. If you're going to choose a worldview and you have, here's this arrogant philosopher saying the Weltgeist is working its way out through my thinking, and a Paul or a Peter, then do look at what those worldviews are actually saying, and you make your choice. I don't think it's difficult, really. Hegel, however, would say, I don't disagree with your nice Christian religion of Paul and Peter speaking for God. I believe that they were speaking for God. The Weltgeist was giving in a very low level, undifferentiated, vague, and not highly sophisticated form, the truth of what I'm giving you. Remember I told you that before. Hegel considered Christianity to have its own, again, unsophisticated, but nevertheless, its own expression of what his philosophy was saying. So Hegel would try to double back on you, given your testimony in here. He'd say, I agree with you, because what your Christianity is all about is what I've been saying. Now, does that help in terms of this war between Christianity and Hegel, or does it make his offense all the greater? I maintain this shows that his offense is even greater. Not only did he think Weltgeist was working its way out through his system of philosophy, he dared to say, and that's what Christianity truly is when properly interpreted. Well, let's take a short break. Well, now that we've gotten through the toughest part of Hegel and his discussion of philosophy as the culmination of spirit, I want to go back and look at another part of the development of spirit in Hegel, the subjective spirit, that tells us something of his social and political views. Remember subjective spirit? The last category of subjective spirit in its triadic development is freedom. And so of great concern in Hegel's socio-political theory is the concept of freedom. But we need a more precise, determinative, and adequate concept of freedom than we usually have. And so we have to take a look at what Hegel worked out rationally as the proper view of freedom in society and politics. Where do we immediately experience freedom? Hegel said, in our personality. When I consider myself as a person, I'm immediately aware of my freedom. I mean, I like what I want to like. People don't tell me what to like. I do what I want to do as much as I can. I am a free individual. I'm not a cog in a machine. I'm not some kind of predictable, determinative, fully worked out object that doesn't make any choices. I am free. I know that immediately. So personality is my immediate experience of freedom. Now, the moral problem I have is when I get beyond subjective spirit and have to deal with other spirits, they too are free. And so the moral problem is how do I maintain abstract right? That is to respect the rights of others and my rights as well. It means not infringing on my personality, but not infringing on the personality of others either. So this is an observation that's been made in so many different places that it's not any great insight of Hegel's, but it's like, if we're going to respect personality in ourselves, then we must respect personality in others. So I am free, but I must respect the freedom of others. When I think in this way, I am distinguishing between persons and things. Okay, a thing is not a person. Or you can say that a person is a thing as an object of thought, but there are impersonal things like rocks and trees, and personal things like human beings. Over impersonal things, we have property rights. Okay, so if I own a car, I have a property right to use it as I freely choose, and you've got to respect that property right. I have an absolute right over impersonal things. When you wrong me, when you violate my rights, Hegel said, at this level of thinking, wrong is seen as a violation of a contract. At the level of abstract rights, when we wrong one another, we are, in a sense, violating contracts. We have an agreement that this is my car, you don't drive it. So you have violated that contract when you steal my car. This level of thinking is the level of abstract right. But when we think more adequately about freedom, we realize that abstract rights are an oversimplification. You can't have morality just be a morality of contracts, property rights. Why is that? Well, because personality is much more complex than that would lead you to think. Personality is often divided against itself. Isn't that right? Sometimes there's a contract right or an abstract right, a property right, that people observe, but their hearts are not in it. That is to say, what they are doing is lawful, but their motivation is not good. And sometimes people violate the law, property rights, contract rights, and they do it with goodwill. That is to say, their motivation is a good motivation for overriding what is a low-level property right. Okay? You own your house. You have no trespassing signs up around your property. But from the road, I can see that you're undergoing a heart attack and you need help. So I violate your property right, my contract with you, as it were, and I trespass on your property so that I can get you and carry you to a hospital and save your life. So I violated the law, but my motive has been good. On the other hand, there are people who keep the law and their motivation is really selfish or whatever it may be. So Hegel said, you can begin with the concept of freedom and respect other people's freedom, and ethics at that point is a matter of contractual right over property. But there's more to morality than that, because the self, if you're going to have a more adequate conception, can be divided against itself. You have to take not only the lawfulness of your behavior into account, you must take into account the motivation of your behavior. And when we engage in wrongdoing, we notice that the self at that point is divided against itself. Wrongdoing shows the self to be divided against itself. Why? Because in that it's wrong, and you recognize that it's wrong, your self is loyal to the law. yourself identifies with the law, and that's why you feel that what you're doing is wrong. And yet, you're the one who's doing it, and so you are really loyal not to the law, but to yourself, the doer. And again, I'm not. This is, you know, not some kind of pseudo-profundity. I think there's a real important insight here. That's true. When we feel guilt for what we are doing, in a sense, we're a divided person. Because we are identifying with the law that we break. We say, I agree with this law, and yet I have to identify with myself who is breaking the law. That's why I feel guilt. Read Romans, the 7th chapter. Paul feels terrible about the fact that he agrees with the law and the inward man, and yet the things that he doesn't approve of. But he does them. He's the lawbreaker. And so guilt shows a divided personality. So we need to talk, we need to get a more self-conscious and accurate concept of freedom and morality than what we have at the level of abstract rights. And so this leads us to a discussion of the ethical life, according to Hegel. And the ethical life, the notion of rights, stands in dialectical tension with the notion of goodwill or motivation. How do you resolve right, lawfulness, and motivation as they stand possibly over against each other? He said the resolution is in realizing that the moral life must transcend the finite and private individual and take account of the larger will and good of society, of which the individual is simply a part. That is, we have to move beyond considerations of contract and conceive of our true good as full and loyal participation in the whole of society. Okay, so you begin with contract rights, that's real individualistic. But then you realize that morality is more than that because of the divided personality, it's more complex. How do you resolve that? Then you need to move beyond contract rights into a consideration of the whole society of which you are a part. Now, within the family, to talk about the lowest level social organization, within the family, we have informal, immediate relationships.